This episode of Hansel Minutes is sponsored by Datadog, now offering Cloud Security Posture Management, CPSM. Datadog provides one-click compliance posture. With Cloud Security Posture Management from Datadog, you can ingest data from 450 integrations. You can audit your infrastructure configurations fast. Avoid alert fatigue through Datadog's efficient and dynamic aggregation of audit findings. And get the right alerts to the right teams with bespoke views of possible misconfigurations and violations. Get set up quickly with out-of-the-box detection rules mapped to CIS benchmarks and relevant controls from PCI DSS, SOC2, HIPAA, and others. Learn more by signing up for a free 2-week trial by visiting datadoghq.com/hanselminutes-security. That's datadoghq.com/hanselminutes-security or the link in the show notes. And as a special offer to Hansel Minutes listeners, you can sign up and receive a free Datadog t-shirt. Hi, I'm Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today I'm talking with PhD candidate Crystal Mon. How are you?
I'm great today. How are you doing?
I'm glad. I'm interested that you just said I'm great today, which I think is an acknowledgement that we're not great every day. And I appreciate that. That's actually a good thing. I should start answering how are you with I'm great today.
Well, I didn't want to lie. I feel like sometimes it's okay. It's definitely okay to say that you're having a bad day. And I would definitely say that the PhD process in general or the grad school life is full of ups and downs. So if anyone says I'm great or I'm good, they're probably lying.
I'm currently working on a black belt in Taekwondo, and I feel like I'm about to end because I'm going to get my first, what's called the first dan. And my, you know, the guy in charge, right, the master of it, is saying, no, this is when it all starts. I wonder if the same thing, like, do you feel like it's going to end or it's just going to begin again? You know what I mean? Like, he's like, no, it's a lifelong learning. When you get a PhD, you're going to like spike the ball in the end zone and be like, I'll never see you people again. Boom, I'm a doctor.
No, definitely not. So I think there's a lot of misunderstanding in general about what the PhD is. And it reminds me of something one of my advisors was saying today about how Hulk from the Marvel Universe has 7 PhDs and how that's a little bit overkill, because the whole point of a PhD is to train you to do research. So over time, you learn to be a researcher. So a lot of these kind of highfalutin ideas about, you know, doctor and PhD, I think are a little bit conflated with the actual intent of the PhD, which is to begin or launch your research career. So that's how I see it. So I see it as a beginning.
Interesting. I think that your professor got that from a meme that's going around TikTok right now, where a PhD declared that Hulk having 7 PhDs makes no sense. What he would be doing is a lot of different postdoctoral research. And he'd be like off exploring other things, but you're not going to stop, then go back and then reset and then start a new PhD. That would be like an unusual thing to do, right?
Yeah, definitely.
But you just kind of confirm that it is the beginning, though. Like, it's not the end, and you're like, yeah, I'm done, boom, I got a doctorate, and then you run around saying call me doctor when you like check into hotels and stuff. It's the beginning of your research at that point, and then you spend your life in academia, or do you go to work somewhere?
So you actually have a number of choices. I see it more as and I talk about this a little bit in my blog, it's the beginning of finding a community. So throughout the PhD process, what you're doing, especially in the beginning years, is finding where you belong, where you fit. And once you found that group of people or group of researchers or even non-researchers, it really doesn't matter. You kind of go, those are my people. And the next goal is to kind of make or become part of that community by contributing to that, giving back to that community. And they stay with you throughout your career, or sometimes you engage with other communities as well. But one of my other advisors calls it finding a home. So you're really just finding a home. And I feel like this is related to tech as well, where especially if you come from a non-traditional background, a lot of your time, because no one tells you what to study and how to study and how to get your first job, a lot of it is spent trying to figure out where you fit and, you know, should I do cybersecurity? Should I do software development, what kinds of software development. And so there are a lot of things that are related in that respect.
Mm-hmm. So you're currently a PhD researcher. You're going to graduate in a couple of years, or not graduate. Like, what is it called? Is it graduating, or is there a better word?
I believe it is getting your doctorate.
You get your doctorate. But when I look at your LinkedIn, it's full of like, you focus on differential and data privacy and machine learning and cryptography. Is it a computer science PhD, or is it all of these things? Because you have like 9 things you're interested in.
Yes. So I've heard that a lot, and that is true. And that's kind of how I ended up here. Right now, I think I found, interestingly, so I was formerly somebody who started off with a very wide berth. And I found that over the years, the more and more I've thought about what my direction is, it's really narrowed. So only recently I found out that I really, 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 really like the isogeny community. So the isogeny community is, there are a lot of PhD mathematics people, but also computer scientists as well. And it's this particular form of post-quantum cryptography that is based on this mathematical construct called isogenies. So based on that, there's this form of post-quantum cryptography called isogeny-based cryptography. And I believe that since I found that community, I really don't have a desire to be a part of any other community. But before finding that, I was kind of jumping around to all these other different communities because I couldn't quite fit. And there were little parts of each community that I was like, oh, that's interesting. But a lot of those communities didn't really hold me. And that's very similar to how you feel in tech as well. So I was kind of wandering around a little bit with, I did the front, interested in front end, interested in learning to code communities, interested in I even went to a C# meetup at one point in time when I was in Los Angeles, and all these different things. And I kind of jumped around, and I spent a good year when I was in Los Angeles, and I was first interested in tech, kind of figuring out like, do I like this? Do I like this group? Is their meetup interesting? Are these people interesting? Is that where I want to go? And if you knew me during that time, you would say, wait, you're in an Elixir meetup and a C# meetup? That's really strange. But after about a year and a half, I kind of found a place that I was like, I think I want to just not be a part of these communities anymore. And then eventually I kind of honed it down. So I think that's kind of a common pattern with me. And I think that's actually okay, because then you don't have FOMO. You don't have that fear of, is that what I should be doing? And this is the first time, I think, in a while that I felt, since I joined this particular community, that I can see myself staying for a really, really long time.
That's cool. Then you go from FOMO, the fear of missing out, to JOMO, the joy of missing out.
Yes, definitely.
So let's back up, because you throw out a couple of big words there, and it's always fun to unpack big words. And the word something-a-geny, isogeny, it sounds like a lot of things. And some people may have heard that and may have misheard misogyny. Isogeny, right, and isomorphism before it, is this idea of equality between mapping two things together.
Yes.
And when applied to quantum based encryption, quantum encryption, you're talking about encryption that is resistant to quantum attacks, right? Because the worry is right now that like encryption is going to like fall, because everyone's going to be able to go and pick up a quantum computer at like Best Buy in the future. And then run attacks, and then that'll be the end of it. So it sounds like there's a big race right now to come up with the uncrackable encryption, and that'll be isogeny based.
Well, everybody's kind of looking at different areas of research. There is one in the third phase of the NIST post-quantum competition right now that is isogeny based. But I think it's interesting in general, just because there are a couple of things, right? So that particular field draws upon abstract algebra. And if you've looked at my history at all, I have been involved in the Haskell community, and people who are drawn to the Haskell community in general tend to enjoy abstract algebra. The other aspect of isogeny-based cryptography is that it's made up of these isogenies. This particular type of isogeny graph-based cryptography is made up of these large random graphs called expander graphs, and their randomness makes them very difficult the hardness of the problem that the DLP, discrete log problem, comes from the randomness and how large they are, which is really interesting because then you start to think about things like random walks. And, you know, if you had two people trying to get to the same point as in a Diffie-Hellman key exchange, but you quantify that instead in terms of a graph-based type of problem where you're doing a random walk, how would you decide to exchange information? And how would you make sure that someone listening in might not be able to discover what their path was? And I think that, I don't know, those kinds of questions are just really interesting.
Is everything at the PhD level and beyond in computer science so deep in math? Because as a lay person, I'm thinking you should be a math PhD. What is the difference?
No, don't say that.
I'm just saying there's a lot of math in isogeny-based post-quantum cryptography.
So there is, and I have been. So one of my professors or one of my advisors, her name is Dr. Christelle Vincent. She is a pure mathematics or in particular number theorist. So I'm working with her on the mathematics side, and she's bringing me up to speed on the abstract algebra and number theory type of work and my foundation. And then my other advisor is privacy and differential privacy based, and he's on the computer science side. So I think that isogenies in general is a very math-based field in terms of the cryptography scene and, you know, in terms of that breadth of fields. However, not all of those fields are. So it depends on what you go into. Like if you're interested in side channel attacks, for example, maybe you may not necessarily need a particular type of mathematics. Or if you're interested in particular types of blockchains, there's a person that I was working or a group I was working with recently that was interested in front running attacks for MEVs. And in that case, maybe you're interested in a particular type of mathematics or statistics or whatever you need for evaluation or graph based or combinatorics. But it really depends on what you are pursuing. So if you're doing something like building compilers, maybe you might be interested in making sure that they're rigorous enough provably from a theoretical standpoint to not have bugs. But if you're building something that is, say, a systems-based infrastructure, maybe you might want something that's more just robust and scalable. And then your concerns are not so much about whether it's bug-free necessarily.
Mm-hmm. This all sounds extraordinary. And if you look at your LinkedIn is just, without using too much of a buzzword, the most diverse LinkedIn I've ever seen. You were at a community college, you did Code 2040 stuff. You were an intern at Apple. You went to NASA. Like, that's just amazing. You were at Cornell for a semester. Like, you're just bouncing around doing all kinds of stuff. When you have said, and you and I have talked offline, that your path was non-traditional. Is it non-traditional because you have so many varied interests and you encourage others to, or is it non-traditional for other reasons?
I consider it non-traditional anyways, because there's a bit of a misunderstanding. So I always introduce myself as starting with a liberal arts background, but I didn't actually start with a liberal arts background. So in high school, I studied physics, mathematics, and art. And I didn't know what to do with that because in my home country, people either study science or they study art. And I believe that's changed now, but we were, in my particular group, we were kind of this small group of about four of us who wanted to do both physics and art. And there was no road besides maybe architecture that would be recommended when you said that you were interested in all of those subjects. Mm-hmm. So at some point, many of us had to pick a path. And so some of us ended up continuing along with science and giving up art. And some of us ended up some of us did study architecture, and some of us studied science, and I couldn't give it up. So I was looking for something that would be able to combine both, which is really hard, especially when you're on an island. We're developed, but I mean, like, you're on an island that is British colonized, and therefore has this educational system that emphasizes certain structures that were from the British that don't necessarily inform the way education can exist or what it could be. So a lot of my educational experience, for example, was based on the British A-level and O-level exam. You're put along a path. So you either end up in the science class or you end up in the languages class or the business class or the arts, and there's no intersection. So I didn't know until I saw those Disney movies that we have spoken about several times, that when I was growing up, so, you know, Lion King and Beauty and the Beast, and seeing CAPS, which is this kind of motion capture technology to integrate 3D motion into a two-dimensional space. When I started seeing that in filmmaking, it kind of ignited this idea that you could do something that was both creative and technical. And that was the first time I thought, well, here's my escape. I'm not going to just do the traditional thing, but I didn't know how to get there. So I spent about a year working in my home country in technical theater and even on a film, on local films, to kind of figure out, is this what I want to do? And I mean, it was a lot of fun, but I also ran into a lot of walls because it was a very burgeoning industry. And there's also a lot of, it's very traditional. It was very traditional as well. So someone like myself was not, usually if you're female, people saw you as an actress. And, you know, so when I was like, no, I'm here to do like lighting or technical theater, people were a little bit astonished. And, but I had a lot of mentors during that time. And it really solidified in my mind that this was a space that could be both technical and creative. So I decided to go off and study that in undergraduate study.
There's a lot to unpack there. So when you were talking about 3D and 2D in the context of Disney, it made me think about the moment when we all saw Belle and the Beast dancing in a three-dimensional space. And there's that moment where the whole film changes, but it also doesn't change. Texturally, everything's the same, but a camera move occurs when Beauty and the Beast are dancing, and you go, how in the heck did they pull that off? Two-dimensional, cel-shaded people dancing in 3D space. A lot of math, but it was absolutely art. That's what came to mind the first time. And then, of course, the stampeding scene in The Lion King, which was technically extraordinary and absolutely not drawn entirely from hand. Wow. Okay. So, and also growing up in a Commonwealth country, I'm hearing you say, paraphrasing, that the powers that be didn't know what to do with you. You're one of those gifted kids where it's like, well, hang on, you've come to a fork in the road now. We need you to hang a left or a right. And you're like, no, I'm going to do both of these things. And I refuse to pick a path.
That was, I think a lot of us ended up kind of choosing one or the other, because the traditional path is usually that you become a doctor, a lawyer, engineer. And our school is also, our high school is also based on this exam that you have to sit when you're 10 or 11. And based on how you do in this 3-hour long exam, you are placed in a school. And that school determines whether you learn enough to go to university or whether you're placed more into a trade school type scenario. And so there's a lot of pressure based on that system. And I guess like having that perspective now and looking back, I realize I'm amazed by how much I was able to accomplish and in that system, and how much of that system really emphasized regurgitation more so than creativity. But I think that it's changing. And one of the persons that I have to give, I'm in awe of, both of my parents, but my dad as well, because he worked in the development sector of the Caribbean for several years. And what he tried to do in several ways, both in terms of the educational system and just infrastructure, was bring some of those ideas about innovation and about our thinking of ourselves as innovators back to our country. And it's a hard thing to do, because in many ways, when you're a lot of those countries that set up those systems in the Caribbean, they really made it difficult to kind of do your own thing. Like you there's a lot more risk involved than if you just kind of maintain the status quo and continue just maintaining systems that they set up within our country.
Yeah. Let's face it, your code is going to have errors, and even code written by an amazing developer such as yourself, errors do happen. But it's nice to know that Honey Badger has your back. Honey Badger makes you a DevOps hero by combining error monitoring, uptime monitoring, and check-in monitoring into a single, easy-to-use platform. They send you alerts in real time with all the context needed to see what's causing the error and where it's hiding, so you can quickly fix it and get on with your day. Honey Badger's included uptime and cron monitoring also lets you know when your external services are having issues or your background jobs go missing or silently fail. Go to honeybadger.io and discover how Star, Josh, and Ben created a 100% bootstrapped monitoring solution. Why is that important? Well, self-funding means that they only answer to you, the developer, and not some venture capital overload. Check them out at honeybadger.io. That's HoneyBadger.io. My wife grew up in Zimbabwe, which had similar Commonwealth-based education. And while she believes that the memorize this entire book of stuff and regurgitate it is a valuable skill, she recently went back to school, switched careers entirely in her 40s, and became a nurse. And while it was hugely challenging work, she just, you know, memorized everything because that's how nursing works. And then regurgitated it and passed all the different exams, and then found creativity in the world of nursing, but has said that the folks that couldn't memorize and regurgitate definitely struggled in her, you know, while she was watching them. Well, she's like, yeah, my rigorous Commonwealth background both hobbled me through a lack of creativity, but also set me up for success because I can memorize stuff at scale. It sounds very scary to me because I wasn't even conscious until I was like 19. Like, I don't even remember 10. How, give me a test when I was 10. I don't know what I would be doing today. I'm not ready to make that decision.
I think it also does something to you. And this kind of ties into tech about how you see yourself and your value when you're constantly under the structure of another entity. Mm-hmm. Because you kind of, I'm in a block algorithms group. For software engineers on Facebook and LinkedIn. And it's interesting because the person who runs the group, he had a really great video recently where he spoke about his journey and how he came to tech. And one of the things that he emphasizes is financial independence. And I think that it's really hard when you are within a structure where you're just trying to, when you just, you feel like, oh, having this job or getting access to this job is enough. Like, that's all I need. You know, especially when you're struggling. Like, when I was trying to get into tech at first, I thought, oh, you know, just getting anyone to call me back and just, you know, just having an opportunity to interview is enough. But getting to that point where you could really advocate for yourself and realize that you have worth is so important. And I see that in the context of where I'm from and how we went from kind of, oh, like the British or, you know, so many whatever colonizing country to really saying like, no, like independence is important for us and having our own dreams is important for us. And a lot of that and that kind of thinking, I think, was influenced by my non-traditional path because a lot of the arts, and I talk about this a lot with my engineering friends, there's something about if you have done a lot of the traditional engineering path, I think, that can prohibit your ability to take on risk. So a lot of my friends can sometimes feel a bit afraid of just trying something new. You know, it's like you're making good money and you have a good career, but they're afraid to try, you know, what if I took some time off and tried a thing? And in the arts, one thing that I noticed was that well, first of all, you start off as a contractor. So you're immediately expecting that I have to say what my value is. I have to advocate for that. Sometimes I have to make my own thing. Like I have to start off small. Maybe I buy a little product. I do some editing for somebody and then I sell that. And then as people like my product, I grow my business. So that's very kind of tied in or built into the concept of being an artist or freelancer, especially in filmmaking. And sometimes I wish I could kind of bring that into the world of the engineer, just so that, because I think that it's such a powerful thing to be able to make things. And sometimes I feel like we don't, as engineers, you're almost taught not to advocate for yourself and see your worth.
That hits hard because I've actually felt a little bit like that myself. That combined with the healthcare situation in the US has made me far more conservative in the unable to make a move kind of thing because I'm a type 1 diabetic. So my insurance is absolutely essential and I can't just go and buy insurance on them like the open market and then have it not be a real problem. That combined with this ongoing fear that I'm not keeping up on the latest tech is a sense of like, oh yeah, you know, my contractor buddy might say, I'm going to take 6 months off. And I'd be like, if I took 6 months off, they might forget that I work here. Like, what if I came back and there was no job? And what if I broke my leg? And all of these, like, what if, absolutely stunts your growth. It sounds like having decided to do this stuff is what's allowed you to, going back to your kind of your LinkedIn, to fill in all of this really fun and diverse stuff, like 5 months here and 4 months there, and let's do this and all of that. Are you just following your nose and saying, huh, I'll go try to be an intern at Apple, and hey, NASA sounds cool, and you just do it? I mean, it's a combination of tenacity and this winding path, this wonderful winding path.
I think that I just, at that point in time, I just really was, and I think I still am kind of searching, and I look a lot at what, I think a lot about what I'm not just lacking, but I'm kind of naturally curious about a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And sometimes something just catches my curiosity and I tend to go down that rabbit hole. Mm-hmm. And at that point in time, at least when I was in Los Angeles, I was going to night school, and somehow I went to this Linux meetup because a friend of mine was giving a talk on this personal weather system, I believe it was. He works at Jet Propulsion Lab. And I was in the group and I turned around. I made a joke, you know, and somebody laughed. And then he gave me his card. And as it turned out, he worked at Jet Propulsion Lab. And he was a mathematician. JPL,
who works with NASA, for folks that may not know.
Yes. Yes. They do all the robotics for Mars rovers. But my professor also at community college was a roboticist for the Mars rover as well. But that particular person ended up being a mentor for me and encouraged me to pursue grad school. And so I think that a lot of my experience, and this is why I'm kind of also an advocate for people with different perspectives and knowing their worth and contributing, is that there, I felt like my path was a series of things that were unexpected, just connecting together in ways that I didn't anticipate. A great example is that whole decision to go to grad school was based on the fact that a friend of mine he's the inventor of PureScript, which is this functional programming language based on Haskell. And his name is Phil Freeman. He was a really great mentor for me, especially at the beginning when I was consistently going to there's a group called Santa Monica Haskell meetup. And he'd drive me, myself and another person home after the meetup and that sort of thing. And he said that he was supposed to present a paper or submit a paper to this conference. And at that point in time, I didn't know what the conference was, but I thought that I should support him. And I really wanted to see what he was going to talk about. So I couldn't afford the costs of the ACM conferences because they're always super expensive, which is what I like about IACR, the Cryptological Research Society, is that they keep their costs low. But anyways, so I signed up to volunteer as a PhD student, and I got, well, as a volunteer, which is usually PhD students, but for some strange reason, it happened to be in LA that year, it was 2018, and it happened to be the same, just everything just aligned. The fact that they were like, okay, you can be a student volunteer. It happened to me in my city. My job at the time was okay with my leaving to go, like, during the day or whatever, or taking a day off to go volunteer. And at that conference, what happened is that the professors and people there saw something in me and said, you know, you should really think about doing grad school. And my first response was, no, I'm not going to go into debt for school, because my usual association is college debt. Like, you know, school equals college debt. And they said, no, like, you'd be funded, and this is the kind of stuff that we do and that sort of thing. And it was a feeling that it was really riveting. Like, you know, I'd never had, it felt like a kind of a pivot or a turn. And I think that there are little kind of moments in your life that define those kinds of pivots. And I was kind of open to seeing where it would lead. And as it turns out, it ended up leading to grad school for me. And I think a lot about how if I didn't have all those things line up, I might not have ended up in grad school. And that's why I kind of also think about how I could bring other people who don't necessarily have all those things line up to still give them access to those kinds of opportunities.
I did a thing on Twitter a couple of years ago as a hashtag called Be the Luck, where all of those things you describe are very lucky. But of course, luck is a combination of opportunity presenting itself, but then being prepared for that opportunity to present itself. Like all those things could have happened to a lesser person who would then not be prepared, and then it wouldn't happen. But you know, you told the right joke at the right time, and the right person was sitting behind you, that they didn't have to give you their card, and on and on and on and on. So then now that you're farther along, that you've taken that fork in the road and you're way, way farther along, there's other people at the fork behind you. You can be their luck. And years later, they'll go, oh, you know, I met Crystal at this thing and she gave me her number and, now I'm the king or whatever. But for them, it'll be luck, but you orchestrated just a little nudge, a little, hey, you know, maybe you should go to grad school. It's little moments of luck plus being prepared for you to go now and make luck for others is a very powerful position to be in.
There was a similar thing that happened to me. I don't know if it's on my blog as well too, but there was, so somehow, because I was hanging out in the Haskell community at that point in time, and I had just gotten laid off from a job that I was doing to pay my bills while I was going all over LA doing all this tech stuff. And although it was at a place that was manufacturing high-speed lights at that point in time, which sounds bizarre, but that's kind of what I was involved in. So I had gotten laid off from that because manufacturing, unfortunately in America, there's a whole history of, you know, it's very hard to be competitive and to, you know, make a lot of money in certain parts of manufacturing. So I've gotten laid off and what I decided to do was spend as much time as I could on the things that I could control, which was still going to school. So I would show up at the library, the school's library, every morning when it opened. And as it turns out, I had applied for Google Summer of Code. It's to the same community that I was hanging out in, and they chose me to do that mentorship. But I didn't have a great computer. I had a $30 laptop at that point in time. And I don't know why. I was so naive thinking that, oh, you know, I could do Google Summer of Code on a $30 laptop. And of course, that was wrong. So my mentors, the other chance that I took, I think taking chances is important, which is what we spoke about in the freelancing. There was another mentor who sort of decided to be my mentor, and we just got along and is still a mentor for me today in the Haskell community. And what they did is, they weren't originally part of the proposal, but I asked, could you look over it for me? And they said yes. And I thought that they had done so much to help me that I just put their name as one of the mentors, and Google didn't seem to have a problem with it. So that person ended up being my mentor along with the maintainer for the open source library. But I still had this computer problem. So I also took a chance, and there was this person called Nadia Ekbal who was running this grant called the Helium Grants.
She's been on the show.
Yes, I saw that. It's like, it's so crazy. You know, she's given so much. Like, she's given back so much and just kind of been this person who's not just received, but given back. And I don't know if she knows how much it's affected the lives of so many people. But at that point in time, I didn't have a working laptop, and it was very difficult because we were trying to pair program, stream, and run GHCS on this laptop and on this $30 laptop. And it was taking all day to build just the code base. So I took a chance and decided to write Nadia for the Helium grant and apply, knowing that it was probably slim because there's so many people who applied. And it was this, a certain amount of money, no strings attached. And midway through, I saw this email in my inbox and it said, congratulations, you're out of 700 people who applied, you were one of 11 people chosen. If I hadn't taken that risk, I might not have gotten that opportunity and also gotten to know Nadia. And so like little things like that. Like, I think along the way, my whole journey has been just kind of people taking or seeing something or investing something. And that's something about tech that I think it runs throughout. There's also another person. So my grad school too experience. Before grad school, I was trying to figure out which advisors I wanted to possibly advise me. And I went to a particular conference, and one of the advisors that I applied to their school, I was at this particular conference, and I was a volunteer because I couldn't afford to go there on my own. And they were heading to the next event, and I was telling everyone, you know, go down the stairs, go turn left, you'll find whatever. And they said, you should apply to my school. And I said, really? And they said, yeah. And they gave me their card, and I followed up, and I got into, that was one of the schools I got into. So again, this little series of mm-hmm. opportunities that eventually led to things.
One of the things, as I wanted to add as we close our chat today, that I think you might not be giving enough credit for, is you've said multiple times in this interview that people saw something in you. But you've shown up. And what I'm seeing, though, is a consistent showing up to big events, small events, being present. And I say a lot when I mentor people in tech that, like, 90% of it is showing up. It sounds like you're always like, oh, there's a community. I'm looking for my people. What's my tribe? If there's a small event, they're going to talk about this. You go to those things. It's difficult now with the virus, but you know, when things start to open up again, meet up and user groups and get togethers and table, like, that's how you get seen. Tell the right joke, have the person behind you give him your card. You show up. And you've consistently shown up. You should give yourself credit for that.
Thank you so much. I haven't thought about that before. A lot of the time I just feel so indebted to that whole community, because it really feels that way in tech. I know, like, tech has a lot of problems, and, you know, in its own right, and nowhere is perfect. But for me, my whole story, I felt that it had given so much to me. And even though I really wanted it, there are other industries that I really wanted to be a part of and fought really hard. And there's sometimes doors just don't open. Mm-hmm. And I felt that one thing about tech, though, is that if you do put in the work and you do show that initiative, that even if, and it is hard, especially when you're getting your foot in the door, but there are so many people who kind of help you and mentor you, and they want to make sure that things are okay for you, and they become your community, and they become people who support you and advocate for you. And that has kind of informed how I see myself in tech, as kind of like, not, it's not me. It's kind of more of a network of people that will grow over time and who... And so I want to support that. And I'm always looking out to, like, advocate for and help people in the same way that so many people helped me when I was getting started.
Very cool. Well, thank you so much for chatting with me, Crystal Mon. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.